I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the School for Dumb Women, the podcast where we investigate the things you're too proud to admit you know nothing about. I'm your host woman, Flat Earth conspiracist Hannah Varrell. Joining me is drinks her own piss for health reasons, Alexandra Haddo.
Have I once had to go to hospital for drinking my own piss? No, Hannah. Drinking bleach? Yes. What does that tell you?
And can't tell the difference between a jade roller and a jade egg, Caroline O'Donoghue.
I ate the egg, so the roller had to go in the other end.
Today we're keeping it light and fluffy by discussing the country of Norway, optimism, and how to have a famous, famous child.
So, Caroline, your topic today is one of the most sought-after travel destinations in the world, but I can't afford to go there.
Well, they wouldn't inlet you in, would they?
Oh!
So I found out today that despite the fact that Norway is very famous for its fjords, I had no idea what a fjord was. Did you?
Isn't a fjord like a ravine between two mountains?
Yeah, yes. You're at
water. It involves water, doesn't it?
Okay, I thought this was going to be one of those things where nobody knows where a fjord is, but it turns out I was the only one. Yes, it's exactly what you said. Yes, it's a kind of an inlet with water. Yeah, it's a ravine.
Is it always by the sea?
It seems like.
Kind of like an inland.
Yeah.
Seems like. So my subject this week is the country of Norway. And I don't know about you, but one of my sort of coping mechanisms, both for this pandemic and I think for my life as well, is getting randomly interested in countries where I've never been and I don't know anyone.
Yes.
And like I remember, you know, when you're a kid and you get those like little journals to fill out and says like, my name is X, my hobbies are this, my pet's name is this. Yeah. I found one of those belonging to me from when I was 9, and it said, my name is Caroline, I am 9, my hobbies are Egypt.
Oh. Yeah, because all school teaches you is like the pyramids.
I know. And then do you remember as well, like I was obsessed with this magazine that used to go out where, you know how like in the 90s was a big time for magazines with a free thing?
Yes.
And the free thing with this would be like the sort of a tiny plasticky black sculpture of like an Egyptian bust. And like it would be like Nefertiti and Horus and all these gods and stuff. And I had like my collection of them and they were like my most precious thing.
Oh, so cute.
I can see that. I can see you being big on Egypt, yeah.
Love Egypt. What did you guys have like a particular like subject, like the Romans or something like that, that you got really into?
Egypt was probably it because there was a lot of mystique around Egypt. Like the
and
pyramids.
Also it's very femme as well.
Yes, like Cleopatra and... you know, the
cats.
Pyramids were like, it was always like, I remember we had to devise, you know, traps that we could have in the pyramids so that people couldn't raid them. And
oh, that's good.
You know, because they had like loads of traps to stop anybody like robbing them, because obviously in the middle was a king with like shitloads of gold while the people starved.
Yeah. And also like the mummy with Brendan Fraser was like the height
exactly,
of our sexual
yeah.
awakening, I feel, as a generation.
You know, stuff's going to happen. So yeah, I feel like...
Stuff's gonna happen.
Yeah.
So this would be an amazing intro for a subject about Egypt, but
but it's actually not.
It's actually not. So that has manifested this week for me because it's very cold and snowy. And you know when like in England when it's been snowing for more than 2 days and you feel really proud of yourself for being really casual about how it's snowing outside?
Yeah.
And so I've just been walking around the house pretending I'm from Norway. And It's just me being like, I'm from Norway and this is normal.
This is a lovely summer we're having.
It's very, and like, I started saying that as a joke, and then my phone was clearly listening to me, because then like, the next day I started reading a book, and it was a book by Jenny Slate, but she goes to Norway for like a long chapter, and I'm like, oh, this is interesting. Weird that Norway's come up again. And then the next day I was on my Instagram, and suddenly I was looking at Norwegian fjord horses, and I was like, you know, I just kind of kept, Norway kept happening to me.
Yeah, you remind me of myself so much when you like really fad on something hard, and then you have to get it out there that like, you really want to go. You're hoping that someone will be like, I own this cabin in a picturesque fjord.
Oh my god, that is the number one way in which you and I are the same.
I know.
In that we're very the secret, and we just like put it out there, it will happen. But so I started putting out on my social media, I was like, I would like to begin a diplomatic relationship with Norway now, please. And so basically message me, and if you're from Norway, I'll send you one of my books for free. And luckily, only two people took me up on this, because now that we're not in the European Union anymore, it's very expensive to send things to Norway. So
oh,
this
no.
is like this sort of practical joke with myself cost me £20, and I hope it works.
But they're not in the European Union, famously.
Okay, maybe it's just expensive to send things to Norway then.
That's probably why it was expensive.
Oh, they're in bits of it, aren't they?
Yeah, they're a complex
Europe,
country.
Yeah.
And, you know, for that reason, it is really hard to do an entire country as a subject for a poorly researched podcast, whereupon we spend 15 minutes trying to condense something. So I don't really have a narrative of Norway, but I do have what I'm going to call Caroline's Norway Nuggets.
Excellent.
And in the meantime, we can imagine that you're like driving us around the fjords in a,
yeah.
in a kind of,
yes.
you know... big bus.
I'm wrapped up in very cute layers.
Yeah, exactly. I'm from Norway and this is normal. Is
yeah.
I'm from
and
Norway.
Meanwhile, me and Alex are like looking out the window like, we're really near the edge here. Like,
yeah.
Can you drive? She had a license.
she ain't allowed to do this. So I thought I would start with something that would engage you, Alex, because I didn't know this, but Norway and Scotland have a very close relationship. Did you know this?
Oh. I didn't really. I feel like there's one anecdote in the back of my head that's like trying to push through, but I wouldn't have said they had a close relationship. No, I didn't know that.
Well, Orkney for one is was first discovered by the Norwegians, and it's named after one of their people. Orkney
Ooh.
Sounds Norwegian. We all get that.
Yeah.
But so, have you ever heard of Margaret, Maid of Norway?
No.
No.
So she is technically like one of the Scottish queens. And she
Ooh.
Was Norwegian. And it's a very interesting story, actually. So let's take us back to the 13th century. We're in Scotland.
Yes. Everything is very shit. That's my impression.
Everything's very shit. Everyone's dying of dysentery all the time. Oh, there's like constant like clan warfare. We've all seen Braveheart. Everyone lives in a hut.
Yes.
And so within this sort of like long period of like a lot of hassle, like a lot of big, like rough tokes for Scotland happening.
Yeah.
We get King Alexander III, and he sort of represents the longest period of like Scottish stability, I think, during this sort of this Middle Ages period. And he dies quickly. And everyone's bummed. And unfortunately, the preceding 10 years of Alexander III's life is like literally everyone he knows dying of death. Just because it's...
Yeah.
You know, it's
that will do it for you.
Yeah, it's like it's 1250. Everyone's dying for no reason.
Yeah.
And so he has these sons. They die really quickly. His wife dies. He tries to get remarried to this lady called Yolanda, and then he's riding through the night to get to her so he can shag her and put a baby in her, and dies on the way to doing that.
God.
I know. Awful. And so, like, everyone is, like, really bummed about this because nobody wants to end this sort of, this level of, like, Scottish, this era of Scottish stability, and nobody wants all this clan warfare again. And they're like, right, we have to maintain this supremacy here. So what they have is the only living relative of Alexander III is basically his oldest daughter was married off to the Prince of Norway years before. And the Prince of Norway at the time, she was 20, he was 13.
Oh. What?
Yeah. Yeah. And like, despite the fact that, like, I know this is very much like a thing of like, let's not like glamorize these sort of like pedophilic relationships when they're the other way around, because I think people do, you know, when it's like, when it's a young girl and an old man, it's like everyone gets disgusting. But sometimes yeah. there's a temptation when it's the other way around of being like, well, I bet he was thrilled with himself.
Yeah. You know? No way. What a lad.
What a lad. But like, the Norwegians still very much see it this way. They're still like, so Queen Margaret, who was sent over from Scotland to Norway, Alexander III's daughter, they still call her, the translation of it is like, the queen who made a man of our king.
Wow. Basically, the woman who took our king's V-plates.
Yeah, and there's like statues to her over there, and they're still like, they're very, like, very sex positive about this, you know, Scottish woman. So they have a kid who is Margaret, the Maid of Norway. And when she is still like a very small baby, like her grandfather, Alexander III, dies. And Scotland is like, okay, well, Margaret, Maid of Norway, is going to be our queen now because she is literally all we have. Also, her mother, Margaret Senior, she dies in childbirth. So, like, she's a no-go as well.
God, she's leaving two kids, her husband and her kid.
Exactly. Yeah. And at this point, King Eric, who is now King of Norway, he is like, I'm not going to give my only daughter to Scotland because it seems awful there. And also, you guys still owe me money because you never paid for the dowry of my now dead wife. So I'm just not going to give you my daughter, which is a kind of a level of protectiveness over daughters you don't often see in history, which yeah. I enjoy. And so it becomes this thing of, it's a bit like, you know, when you're a kid and you want to convince your parents that you can have a dog, and you're like, oh, you know, I'll be like, you know, super, I'll look after it myself. I swear it'll be the happiest yeah. dog ever. I'll take it for a walk every day. And your parents are like, well, we couldn't trust you with literally anything before this, so why would we trust you now? And they're like, oh, because I'll care more this time. Like, it's that, but the yeah. dog is Margaret, Maid of Norway, who's a one-year-old. And so they do all these things to try and convince Norway that it can be done and that she'd have a nice time. And one of the things that they do is they get 13 men to, like, swear an oath of like chivalry to Margaret, the Maid of Norway.
And I want to like, watch this film now.
I know, it's really, it's so like, it's so King Arthur and his Round Table, because it's like them really dedicated to this idea of like, they're all gonna like band together and protect this woman with their lives, and like anyone who tries to come after her throne, they'll like murder them and stuff.
Right.
Wow.
And so they, and also the King of England says that he'll like get his kid to marry her, and we'll create this big union. And they basically fight for years for her to come over to Scotland and be their sort of heir to the throne. And then they finally get her over, and she dies on the way.
Oh.
No!
And she's 7.
Oh.
I know. It's bad. It's really bad.
Do they know what she died of?
Yeah. What the hell was happening on these ships?
And I think, well, there's kind of, you know, food poisoning maybe. We don't really know. But it didn't even end there, because a few years later, we have the case of the false Margaret. Yeah. So a woman, it's very like Anastasia. It's this woman who's like way older than Margaret would have been. She's like, she arrives on the scene being like, yeah, I didn't die. I was taken to Germany by force by pirates, and they made me marry some German guy. And now I'm finally here and I'm ready to be the Queen of Scotland.
What? And so that's someone that's heard the story and thought, give this a go.
I mean, what an opportunist. That's brilliant.
Yeah. And so the Scottish, I think, treat this with the appropriate disdain that it deserves, and they burn her at the stake.
Oh. You lying witch.
You lying witch. So that was my number one Norway nugget. Did you enjoy that nugget?
I did.
Yes.
Here's some more Norway nuggets. Norway inventions. a Norwegian invented the paperclip.
Oh.
Which, like, doesn't that, like, the paperclip, I've never really thought about it before, but doesn't it seem like the unbelievably, the most Scandi design thing ever?
Yes.
Like, even if you think about it, just looking at it, you're like, yes, of course.
It's the stationary equivalent of, like, the sort of frameless glasses a Scandi architect would wear.
Yeah, yeah. Very that, yes.
Sleek design. It's only, like, actually one piece of wire.
Efficient, useful.
Yeah.
Efficient, useful, has a job, does it perfectly.
Yeah.
And they also invented salmon sushi.
Oh.
Not Japan.
Not Japan. So apparently Japan literally like shunned raw salmon for like most of its history. And then a Norwegian who is called the most Norwegian thing I've ever heard, which was Bjørn Erik Olsen. It's like the grab bag of Scandi names.
Yeah.
He went over there in the 70s and he was like, you know, this would be great with some raw salmon. And he took 15 years to sell raw salmon into Japan and eventually did it. And now sushi has changed forever.
Because salmon's like the main one.
I know. I would have thought of salmon as being the main one also.
Well, there you go. He's got his wish.
So I think the mistake that lots of people make about Scandinavia, I think a lot of people are really fascinated by Scandinavian countries because it seems like they get things right so much of the time.
Yeah.
Like it's the thing of like the government looks after you really well, like taxes are really high, but also like infrastructure is really good. And like basically there's no such thing as sort of being abandoned by the state in the same way people are so frequently abandoned here or in the US. And I think we really do glorify that, and we should glorify those things, and we should like ape, like look to be aping those things. But like,
yeah,
it's not as if that all Scandinavian countries have the same perfect lefty outlook. Like Norway, actually, the ruling party has been center right for quite some time.
Oh, that's weird.
Yeah,
didn't think of that.
Yeah, and like, while there is this really like robust welfare system, it's also, it doesn't see itself as socialist at all. It seems to see itself as like quite sort of capitalist because it has all this kind of oil money and it's quite nouveau riche. There's also this thing of like, you know how here there is this sort of joke that, you know, an Irishman, a Welshman and a Scotsman kind of thing?
Yeah.
Well, there's also the same in Scandinavia where it's like a Swede, a Dane and a Norwegian.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, of course it would be. Like, of course they'd have their own things where it's like Swedes are super like sensible in this sort of like idea. And then Danish people are like super hedonistic because they love sort of drinking beer and taking drugs. And Norwegian people are always portrayed as being like country bumpkins who have got like a fishing harpoon with them or something. And they really resent this.
They're like, we're actually very cerebral.
We invented the paperclip.
Yeah.
We brought salmon to Japan.
Yeah.
But then, like, so there's this thing of, like, as I was just saying a minute ago, of the state welfare system being incredibly good. And I think this is common across most Scandinavian countries where people tend to trust the state and trust that the government is sort of keeping its own face clean. But there's also this thing that's happening in Norway over the last few years. And honestly, I listened to the most harrowing BBC World Service I've ever heard today. And that is a steep contest.
Whoa.
So here, if you have a child and that child is being abused or neglected, it's actually very difficult for that child to be taken away from you. And like, you know, everyone knows someone who works in, you know, a school who's has a horrible story about a kid who's being abused and who like no one is doing anything. In Norway, it's actually the reverse in that it seems as if the child protection services act so quickly to the point where it's way too quick and way too strict.
Ooh.
So I listened to a story today done by the BBC, and I really recommend listening to it. It's fascinating and terrifying, of basically this this family who the father was deemed like simple, and like that's literally what they put on the kind of report. They like he's simple and he can't meet the emotional needs of his child, where like he's just, you know, this guy is a bit like withdrawn or whatever, he's not particularly talkative or something, and his baby was taken away from him with absolutely no interview or anything.
Oh my God.
Wow. Basically, they just decided, and now it's been taken away from him. And like the process for him to visit his baby again is really, really protracted. And this other family who, like, they had five kids, all five kids were taken away from them because they spanked one of their kids.
God.
But like none of the kids had any sort of evidence of, you know, physical trauma, really.
Yeah.
And so it's this thing, and like that sort of sounds like a few fringe cases, but then it was the psychiatrist lady from Norway was saying, like, yeah, like, you know, 140 of us have signed this letter saying that the state has way too much control in this area and it's being abused, and people are like not seeing their children for years at a time over like accusations that are tiny and like not substantiated by anything. And it really reminds me, because one of my oldest friends is Swedish, and I often, Salt Eriksson, her name is, if she's listening, and I always kind of come to her with these like, oh, I wish the rest of the world was like Scandinavia and you guys are so great. And she's saying, like, she often says to me, you know, it sometimes can be a burden when people trust the state too much. And it means when right. the state fuck up that often no one will hold it accountable because everyone is so married to the idea of this being this perfect government, because it's kind of a propaganda that gets pushed out into the world.
Yeah.
You know, and like lots of them love the idea that, you know, globally these countries are seen as being extremely forward and progressive, and sometimes they sort of swallow their own story a little too much, and it prevents people criticizing bad actors, you know, which I found really interesting and quite tragic.
Yeah, I never thought about that.
Yeah.
So the kids aren't with their mums and dads, but all the paperwork that has allowed that to happen is very neatly clipped together.
Exactly. And everyone's having a delicious salmon lunch.
And,
yeah. And also, they have some great horses.
Yeah, I want to hear about the fjord ponies.
Oh my God, they're so nice. There are so many like amazing horse influencers from Norway, and I'm following so many of them. I'll put together a list. But like fjord horses, they're just like, you know, like Palomino ponies.
So they're like, they're kind of like gingery.
Blonde, yeah, like yeah. blondy. But
I was
like...
going to say, remember, you guys are horse people. I'm
sorry.
Not.
So they're, imagine like a really squashed, stout Palomino pony. It's
lovely.
Nice. And are they hairy because it's cold?
Yeah, and they've got like thicker hair, and they've got, yeah, they're just, I'll show you some to look at. If you like horses, Norwegian horses are what you want to look at. And if you're from Norway,
very
please
cute.
Invite me over, and I will not criticize the state as I just have now. And that was Caroline's Norwegian Nuggets.
Woo! I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
How do you say goodbye?
Huh?
In Norwegian. How do you say goodbye in Norwegian?
Flower.
Flower.
I would imagine.
How quickly you just had that flower. Flower. Love it.
I'm going to look it up. Goodbye in Norwegian.
I bet it's fla.
Ha det.
I liked your one better. Hannah, am I right in thinking that your segment is about to be the best segment we've ever done on this show?
Oh, I don't know, Caroline. It might just be not quite as good as any of the other ones. I'm joking. Obviously, it's going to be amazing because I am doing a segment on optimism.
Oh, ooh. Lovely. Something
yes.
we all need a huge dose of in this shit show.
Exactly. Absolutely. True words never spoken.
Yeah, I decided to pick this because basically, like, you know, in the words of absolutely everyone, oh, we're all having a hard time right now. And, you know, lots of people basically are looking for reasons to be optimistic, like reasons to be cheerful. And so I messaged you guys the other day because I said that I'd found a lot of people on my social media talking about what time the sun was setting, being like, oh, it's set after 5 today. Oh,
yeah.
By next month it will be setting after 6 p.m. Oh, in summer it will set at like 9 p.m. And it's like, yeah, that's how it works, guys.
Works that way every year.
I am one of that crew, but I just haven't put it anywhere.
No, that's fine. I'm fine with that. It's like, but it seems like on my social media feeds it's become a competition. Like, who's the first person every day that can tell me what time the sun sets? And like,
oh, right.
Like every day, really, genuinely every day. Anyway, I find that very annoying, and I'm a bit too cynical for it. But I think overall, I am mostly an optimist, and like I tend to kind of, if someone's being annoying, I tend to kind of be like, oh, well, maybe they this, or like, oh, perhaps they just, you know, are having a bad day or whatever. Although I am also cynical, I reckon. But interestingly, first fact, the scientists that think that optimism and pessimism are not like on the same scale. So it's not like either or, you can be both. So I find that, I don't know, I think that maybe I'm like an optimist and a pessimist. What do you guys think you are?
I'm definitely an optimist. Put to the point of, I'd probably say irritation.
I think you are really optimistic.
Yeah, you definitely are.
I'm a bitch, but I'm optimistic.
Yeah, and also I think the true test of an optimistic person, and why I know you are one, is you find it really easy to get like G'd up for other people.
Mm. Yeah.
Like you're a really good hype man, which is what makes you such a good friend.
Oh, thanks. No. That's because I'm a tiger mum of any of your achievements.
I think I'm pretty optimistic. Which is a really Eeyore way of saying that, but no, I think I'm a generally I think I'm generally like a fairly sunny person, and I think for a writer, I'm a pretty of that profession, I'm like a pretty optimistic person, because it's a very dour profession.
Jesus Christ, yeah.
I think my most pessimistic attribute is that I tend to, it's like, actually, you know, the Norwegian thing is a good example of it. It's like I feel like I tend to look for flaws and loopholes in what seems like a good system. Like, so for example, you know, a robust social welfare state, but does that mean that people don't question the state enough and the state gets away with more things? Like, so I tend to look for those things a lot, but yeah, so maybe that, I think that's the way in which I'm pessimistic.
But I feel like that's more from a place of like wanting to interrogate stuff rather than being pessimistic.
Yeah, I do think that's pessimistic.
Maybe we're all optimistic then.
Yeah.
I think we are.
I like that.
I like it too.
So I feel like I'd always assumed that optimism was very situational. That, you know, if, you know, like us, you were born in like a fairly wealthy country and, you know, had education and like a family and stuff, like you'd probably be more optimistic. But actually some of optimism is inherited, like through your genes.
That's so cool.
I would totally see that with my dad. My dad's the same as me.
Yeah. And you also, you do meet those miserable families.
Oh.
You know, where everyone's grey.
Oh, everyone's, as my dad would say, everyone's dour.
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 Oh, she's a dour-faced biddy. That's what my dad would say. It's like a miserable woman.
Love it.
But I don't know, I would have assumed that even then it was because of the environment in which the kids were brought up that they were like, oh, okay, well, this is like, they were learning how to see the world through their parents' actions and words and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that they'd be like, oh, okay, so when you get given a chocolate, you're meant to think, oh, why isn't this a Twix? It's only a Mars bar. Rather than, I don't know, getting it and being like, yes, better than no chocolate at all.
Yeah, a minute ago I didn't have a Twix.
Exactly, yeah. But yeah, like so 50%, this is a recent studies, 50% of our optimism is inherited from our genes. Absolutely loads. And then 40% is determined by ourselves intrinsically, and only 10% by others, as in the environment in which we develop, like our family and stuff. Which I think is crazy. 50% inherited from your genes. And it's all to do with the hormone oxytocin, which is the like love and sort of bonding hormone. And they reckon that, yeah, there's some, I mean, if you're a scientist, this would be completely wrong. If you're not, then pretend that I know what I'm saying. But basically there's like something in the gene which is inherited, which sort of allows you to create more oxytocin, or like makes you better at creating it. Which is crazy, isn't it?
That makes sense, though, I guess, like, because I kind of feel like whatever situation I was in, my surface mood would change, but the core of me would still be like, well, I'll make the best out of whatever this is.
Yeah. And it is just hormones, isn't it? Like, if someone would say to you, you know, you would inherit a sort of tendency to create more testosterone from your parents, you'd be like, yep, makes sense.
Yeah.
But somehow when it comes to like personality stuff, we're like, no, it's like, I don't know.
Well, Caroline, you've got three siblings. Are they all optimists?
Pass. Yeah, the thing I was thinking is that my sister Jill is, like, I would call her a pessimist in that she does tend to see the worst side of things. And the upshot of that is that she's incredibly smart, and she's just got a great mind and a better mind than I do. But the bad part of that is that she's often unhappy. I think it's more of a perception thing, in that, like, sometimes she'll be having a whinge to me about something and I'll be like, but what about this, but what about that, and she'll be like, well, no, it's not like that because of the government's this and this, it means that this and this, and I'm like, oh. And I interpret that as being her being unhappy, but actually this is just how she processes things, and she's perfectly happy herself. It's actually, I don't think these things are necessarily related to being inherently miserable, if you know what I mean.
Pessimism isn't always equated with misery as directly as you'd think. You know, you might be, if you don't conflate how you feel about things to your actual mood, like, you can be angry and see the bad in things quite a lot, but then be like, well, can't do anything about it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Pessimist.
Yeah.
Apparently though, like, the majority of people are optimists. Like, it's more common to be an optimist than a pessimist. And I'm saying that as if it's a binary thing. Obviously it's not. And I think there are a lot of people who are just kind of like midway on, if there was a scale, they're kind of midway on the scale, or like a bit of both. But there's a study that says 60% of people are optimists, and there's another one that says 80% of people are optimists, which is quite nice.
Which is an optimistic study.
It's an optimistic study, exactly. Yeah. And like, and as well, like, research shows that optimism is correlated with lots of like positive life outcomes, like increased life expectancy, better health, better mental health, increased success in sports and work, greater recovery rates from heart operations, and better coping strategies when faced with adversity. Which is like, I mean, it all kind of makes sense, and it all makes sense as well why we're so obsessed with it, even in like non-pandemic times. Like, if you Google optimism, you just get, there's like basically nothing apart from how to be more optimistic, here are 7 tips of like how to be more optimistic, here are 5 habits of optimistic people, and it's just like, it's all relentlessly like pushing optimism on you.
Just start taking antidepressants, it sounds like. Release oxytocin into your system.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, I don't know, it's seen as a very positive trait right now.
A negative thing, though, is that it's linked to lateness. Because if you're an optimist, you're like, oh, it's fine, I'll be able to get it done. I'll be able to do that and that.
Yeah.
So you attribute, you think you can do more than you, and then you end up being late, which is me all the time.
Yeah, I have elements of that, definitely. So yeah, and then I got to thinking about I've been watching Sex and the City, so I got to thinking. but I was thinking about being Pollyanna-ish, because that's a phrase that I never really understood. But Caroline, I feel like you'll know where that kind of comes from.
Yeah, I feel embarrassed now because I do say it a lot, and people often don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. Pollyanna-ish, I think it's based on a literary character. I've never read this book, but it was a kid's book, and Pollyanna is like, oh, well, if we just pull together and then everything will be fine. And
yes,
da-da.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I've seen the film.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, I think there is a film of it, yeah. So this book, and it's called Pollyanna, and the phrase is like, oh, you're being a Pollyanna about something, or like, yeah, being Pollyanna-ish. Mm-hmm. Basically, there's this woman called Eleanor Porter who wrote this book. It was published in 1913. It's this orphan who goes to live with her aunt, who's not very nice to her, and she puts her in all these annoying situations. Like one time she punishes her by giving her like bread and milk for dinner and sending her to like eat dinner with the nanny in the kitchen. And Pollyanna is like, oh, well, I like bread and milk and I like my nanny.
I see.
And basically the whole thing is that she plays this game called the GLAD game, which her dad taught her before he died, of any situation, to look at it and think, what am I glad about in this situation? I have to find one thing that I'm glad about in this situation. And so she comes to this town where her aunt lives and like has all these different situations and finds something glad every single time, and kind of starts rubbing off on the townspeople, and they kind of start to be like, oh, well, maybe I'm glad about this. And then Pollyanna gets run over and loses the use of her legs, and she's in hospital. I know. And she's in hospital, like, you know, contemplating a life where she can't walk anymore, and is like, fuck this. This is really annoying. I'm not really glad about this. But then all the people in the town come and visit her and are like, do you know what, Pollyanna? Like, you've done a really nice thing teaching us to be glad, and this is what I'm glad about. And then she's like, okay, we'll be glad. And then she, I don't know, gets the use of her legs back anyway somehow. She recovers.
Wow.
They just did it to teach her a lesson.
Yeah. I don't know. It's quite an interesting message about, like, your influence on other people, though, and, like, karma, I guess. It's all yeah. coming back to her. Mm. But I was really interested in the fact that it was published in 1913, right? Because that was just before World War One was, like, 1914 to 18. And I was kind of like, wouldn't you, in 1914, read that book that was published last year and be like, fuck you, Pollyanna. Like,
yeah,
like read the room.
Yeah, three of my brothers are dead. Like, fuck you. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But apparently it was a bestseller during World War One, and it continued to be a bestseller throughout the Second World War as well. Huh. And people even, like, formed, you know, I said she has this game called the Glad Game, and people formed, like, glad clubs of their own.
Oh, that's cute.
And would be like got really into it.
Probably because they needed that hope and optimism in the war. And if you
exactly,
you weren't in, as long as you weren't in the war, you were like, well, I hope they're okay out there. I hope this and that or whatever.
Yeah. I totally, yeah. I completely see that, though, because if you think as well of, like, times within our living history where pessimism was popular, and what I'm thinking of specifically is, like, kind of 90s era grunge. I feel like it's very pessimistic in its outlook as an art form, like kind of South Park, that sort of, like, quite nasty boy humor that was, like, quite big in, like, the, like, I'm gonna call it the turn of the century. Yeah. And like I feel like there was a good, like, 10, 12 years there where pessimism as an artistic outlook reigned supreme. And I feel like that was happening during one of the most, like, economically stable and outwardly peaceful times for most white Westerners of the last 100 years. And I do think that when people are left to, like, just enjoy their sort of their money and wealth or whatever, that is when people tend to get the most negative. Like, there's this thing that my mom used to always say to me, is that because obviously Ireland has had lots of economic recessions, and she always says, you know, we're not good with money, like, we the Irish, because like, she's like, every time people have money in this country, they become mean and shit. Like, she was like, the Celtic Tiger, which was this, like, really economically great time for Ireland, it's like people were awful to each other in a way that I've never experienced before or since, you know.
Right. Yeah.
So I do think that makes sense.
It's almost like that. The only thing I do have is, like, when things are going too well in my head, I always go, what's going to go wrong?
What's going to go wrong? Yeah, I do know what you mean.
So it's almost like that. We have to create and falsify that pessimism with grunge, because then it balances out the fact that everything's going quite nicely for everyone.
So we have to
forge the sadness.
Well, teenagers are always doing something wrong, aren't they? You know?
Yeah, that's true.
Whatever they're doing, it's bad.
I do feel as well, though, that, like, because, you know, for example, this moment that we're all in right now, I feel like there's an increased sense of, like, as Hannah was just saying at the beginning of the segment, like, you know, look, the sun is rising a little bit earlier and it's setting a little bit later. Isn't it great? I saw a crocus today.
Yeah.
You know, all that stuff. I feel like we wouldn't be doing that in a normal year. We would just be talking about the latest in, you know, what company or public figure is being problematic for some kind of vague reason that we don't quite understand, but we're still pissed off about, you know?
Yeah, probably.
It sounds like a massive cliche, but it's true that it's started to make you appreciate things you can focus on that are good rather than the small things.
That's why
I say the phrase little things, because I do hate it. But things that you wouldn't usually be actively grateful for, you're kind of like, oh, well, at least there's that.
At least there's that, exactly, yeah. But I just find it interesting that being a Pollyanna has kind of become a negative thing now, and it's like, it's associated with being uncritical and a bit stupid, like you're sort of too optimistic and, like, you're not living in reality.
Yeah,
I just think that's interesting. And I have one final story to end, which is absolutely brilliant. This is going to seem like a massive segue. In 1941...
Wow. Right,
the USSR and Britain, obviously allied against German forces, there was this British submarine captain who mentioned to this USSR captain that his wife was having trouble pushing her pram in the snow, and this Soviet admiral was like, oh, you know, you need a reindeer, ha 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 ha. So they gave this submarine captain a reindeer, and the crew, you know, they're like in the middle of the sea somewhere, I don't know.
Yeah.
And they're like, fucking hell, now we've got this reindeer in our submarine. And they called it Pollyanna.
Like a toy reindeer or what?
No, like an actual real reindeer.
In a submarine.
Under the sea.
They were given like a teenage reindeer to take home in their submarine, yes.
Oh my God.
How do you... Aren't submarines famously quite small?
Yes, I think so. But the whole connection here is that the crew, they called it Pollyanna, because I think they were like, well, we can't say no to this gift because, you know, like, we're mates with the USSR, but like, it's a bit tense, so we're just gonna call it Pollyanna and make the best out of it.
Hope for the best. That's so cute. I love that.
As a symbol of hope. Imagine being the first and only reindeer on a submarine. Like, what the fuck is this?
Exactly. So they got a barrel of moss for the reindeer, but it ate it all. So then they had to, like, the reindeer was like just trotting around the submarine, like eating people's scraps. It got really into drinking condensed milk. For some reason, they had a lot of condensed milk. And Pollyanna
so
would
cute.
Sleep under the captain's bed. And apparently she ate a navigation map once.
And they all died.
I love this. And then what happened to Pollyanna in the end?
Well, so after a few weeks, they got back to the UK. But because of all the condensed milk that this reindeer had eaten, she was like too fat to fit out of the torpedo tube, which is how they were thinking they could get her out. And so they had to get a winch. They had to get a dockside winch. This is all on a BBC article. It's amazing. They got a dockside winch with some assistance from a crew man with a broom. Finally managed to get Pollyanna squeezed out of the submarine and onto dry land.
There's your Christmas film.
I know. And then they gave her to Regent's Park Zoo and she lived the rest of her life there.
Oh! That's a way better story than Margaret Maid of Norway who died in transit.
I was going to say, and also reindeer are often, you know, they've probably got them in Norway, so maybe that was the karma of Margaret Maid of Norway.
This is a big episode for symbolic journeys for female figureheads.
Yes.
Yes.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So every episode we like to end on a smart lesson, which is where we try and teach each other the ins and outs of how to be a smart lady in the modern world. And Alex, you're currently trying for a baby, but what would you do if it ever achieved global fame?
Thank you, Caroline. Yes, I am trying to reproduce asexually as we speak. today's smart lesson is how to have a famous child. Now, there's a three-pronged attack to this. I'm going to talk you through each one. It's how to have a famous child if you are already famous. That's prong mm-hmm. one. How to have a famous child if you are a muggle and mm-hmm. your child becomes famous. Number three, how to ensure that you create a famous child. So it's the long game.
I see.
You know, you're actively trying.
That's prong three is you, is it?
Prong three is me, yes. Trying to have a... What are you on about? I'm famous. so prong one, How to have a famous child if you yourself are famous. Very problematic. It often goes wrong, I feel. Mm. Name a child that's very famous with a very famous parent that isn't slightly cuckoo, you know? Like, think about Jaden Smith. He's not, you know, there's something going on there. He's not okay.
Yeah, and Willow.
Willow seems a bit more down to earth, I think. But Beckham children do seem all right, actually. But I would obviously say that because I love the Beckhams and I'll never speak ill of them.
Yeah, but did you see that tattoo?
Oh, yeah. That was a worry for us all. Brooklyn Beckham has had the eyes of his fiancé and a love note that she wrote and tattooed onto the back of his neck.
Not okay. Not all right.
Not okay. Come on, Brooklyn, for God's sake.
I feel like there is definitely a realm of people who are kind of... Their parents were like quite famous but not crazy famous, like Zoe Kravitz, like her.
Yes. Well, they were pretty famous.
I would say she's got famous parents, yeah.
But you know what I mean to say is that she's, you know, it seems like a very well-adjusted, cool person.
Yeah, my favorite ones are the ones that have a different surname to their parents and sort of like semi go under the radar. Like I'm pretty sure Meryl Streep's daughter is an actor.
Oh yes, she is.
Yes, Mamie Gummer.
Yes, what a horrible name, start to finish.
Horrible name. Yeah, it's weird because she tries to go under the radar, but she's also in a lot of movies with her mom. So it's like, pick one, you know? Either benefit from being part of the Streep dynasty or don't. Like,
yeah, well, actually, one of my tips for if you're famous and you've got a famous child, to try and keep them as least annoying as possible is to never allow them in an interview to say, I actually think I got here by chance, just like if my mum and dad was anyone else.
Yeah.
No, you didn't.
Or, no, what's even worse is when they get asked questions about, like, oh, do you think it has anything to do with your mum? And they go, well, yes, my mother certainly encouraged creativity in the household, if that's what you mean. It's like, that's not what anyone means. What we mean is, like, did you get personally introduced to Martin Scorsese at your bar mitzvah? Like, come on. We all know what we're talking about.
Of course you did. But sure, she let me draw in the house. Yeah, and that's the thing as well. And I think there's two paths that you can go. So if we're taking Zoe Kravitz as a sort of example, she seems well adjusted and quite cool and everything because it's all relative for her, right? So she's just like, well, that's just how people grow up. So she hasn't had a self-awareness almost. Not her personally, but those sorts of famous kids. Like George Clooney, his auntie was Rosemary Clooney, who was like a old school Hollywood actress. So I always think the reason he's so down to earth is because he probably just grew up around it and didn't think it was weird. Mm. But then I feel like the stars of kids are the ones who that go, you know, completely off the wall is like they are trying to push the envelope even further, but they've already grown up in a way that was so...
It's very Liza Minnelli, yeah.
Yes, exactly. They've already grown up in a world that's so extreme and so abnormal and stuff, but then they're trying to do their sort of push the boundary. They're trying to do what
like
their parents did.
Rebellion, yeah.
Yeah, but they can't do it anymore because their realms of normal are completely fucked. So I'd say try and keep it all relative. Don't make them out. Don't get them to do interviews where they constantly talk about how there wasn't actually any different for them and how their parents made them get a Saturday job. No.
No, all right.
Now, if you're not famous, just a couple of tips here really, but you have a famous child, try and blag a travel show with them. Divorce your partner and then start sleeping with middle-aged C-listers you meet at parties because you've now got a bit of fame.
Are we subtweeting Jack Whitehall, by the way? Is that what this is?
It's not just him. It's Ramesh Ranganathan.
No, there's so many. There's Russell Howard.
Bradley Walsh and his son.
Oh, everybody. Absolutely everybody has this.
Subtweeting all of them.
Yes, all of them. But no women are allowed this genre. It's only... Oh, well, Ramesh has his mum, actually. It's a very, very common genre. But ideally, as the parent of a famous person, that's what you want. Because you've sort of got the level of fame which... You know, you've probably got a Nando's black card, but you're not going to be stopped in the street.
I feel like my dad is so angry to not have this level of fame. Like, my dad is absolutely dying and crying out for him to have the kind of role in culture where he's like Gogglebox sort of, you know, just a nice man who says cookie things and it's like slightly controversial sometimes and isn't he all saying what we're all thinking? That kind of thing.
Your dad wants to be like the Irish Danny Dyer.
A little bit, yeah. But I think he wants to be full of, like, folksy wisdom, though, you know?
Yes, I could see your dad in that role.
Oh, don't indulge him. Don't ever.
I can't wait till you have to bring him on stage with you at, like, Hay Literary Festival because he's garnered his own corner of fame.
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah, that's basically your only rule if you grow up with a famous oh, also just, you know, kind of be their sort of cool date at parties or premieres so that they don't seem like they're a top shagger all the time. That's how you cope with that. The last prong is how to engineer having a famous child. Now, this takes a lot of work. You have to take them to drama club, music club, you have to encourage everything, you have to turn them into a brat from an early age. And it's basically so that in interviews when they're older, they can say, my mum and dad gave me everything, they drove me to all my... And then they repeat everything that you did where you gave up your life for them for 20 years. You also have to fill your house with interesting people and music all the time so that they can say that in interviews when they're older as well.
Oh, yeah, and also, like, my mom just filled her house with books.
Filled them. Always people in and out. And you know what? 9 out of 10 times when I'm reading an interview with, like, a new model or a new musician or whatever, you'll find out, you'll be like, oh, God, they really did make it from nothing. And then halfway through, it'll be like, and her mum was actually Minnie Riperton.
And her uncle was Richard Branson.
Her house was filled with the Queen of England when she was growing up. Like, and you're like, oh, for fuck's sake. Interesting fact, Minnie Riperton's daughter is Maya Rudolph off of SNL and Bridesmaids. You also... My top tip would be ignore them whilst doing all of this so that they do also crave attention, which will help with trying to garner the fame. So any other tips? That's my three-pronged tips for having a famous child. Oh, maybe have a spat with them if they piss you off. Leak something about them to the press, you know? Keep them on their toes.
That seems wise. I feel like I'm really interested in what Jamie Oliver's doing with his kids because he's got one of his... sons. I mean, we've talked about his kids' names before. I don't know what.
Oh yeah, they're all called like what? Rain Droplet on a Leaf, all of them.
But he's like basically cultivating him into sort of like a child version of Jamie Oliver. And he's got like on his website, because Jamie Oliver's recipe website is very good, he has like recipes by his son. And he's like 7 or something, and it's like Buddy's pancakes. It's like, it's so strange.
I do think it's really weird when any parent says, you know, like kind of does that with anybody under the age of like 16 to 18. And they'll always justify it by saying, oh, they love it. They keep saying they want to do what mummy does. Of course they do. I wanted to work in a bloody call center when I was 7 because you think that's what it is to be adult. Because I'm like, well, my mum works in that. Don't let them do it because they'll go mental. Like, when have you ever seen anybody turn out and be like, oh, they're absolutely fine?
It's really weird that, like, I just think giving a child a job, it's a real hate crime. You know, it's, I don't think it should be allowed. Like,
no, it should be an offence. We were talking about this. How could you criminalise it? Because when have you, you know, especially like Hollywood pushy mums and stuff, it's child abuse. Like putting them in. The Olsen twins like hate their parents, don't they? Because they put them on their first job when they were like 2 months old or something.
Did they? I thought they were pretty okay now. The Olsen twins, no.
They're absolutely round the bend, Caroline.
But they've got that really normal sister.
Yeah. She seems all right, yeah. But I think that's because they took the flack.
Right, yeah, they absorbed all that all that trauma. They're absolutely round the bend, Caroline. Mad.
Have you seen them? They're not okay.
Yeah. Although there is the one thing about the famous parent, famous child thing that I do think is like, it's difficult because like sometimes it's like, it's just pure nepotism. And sometimes it's like, well, clearly this person comes from a creative house and has made stuff like that's good. Do you know what I mean? So and it's really talented.
Absolutely.
The author Ava Rice, who I've had in Sentimental Garbage, her dad is Tim Rice, who's, you know, of Tim Rice fame.
Yeah.
Like one of the most famous lyricists of all time. And like, she's a wonderful writer. He's a wonderful writer. And she gets a lot of flack for nepotism, but it's like, and she probably did experience nepotism, but also I'm glad the books exist. So it's like.
But nepotism isn't always about the, it's not saying that they're not talented. What they just need to admit is that they got the foot in the door to prove that they were or not because of who their dad was. Often if they're shit, they actually won't get that far, but they'll get a bit.
Yeah, you know. Even if it's hate clicks of being like...
Yeah, exactly. Oh, God, like Larry David's daughter,
Yes, yeah.
Often it's we allow them if it's a different space that they're famous in. Yeah. So like, for instance, Stella McCartney is allowed because she does fashion.
Yes. And Sophie Dahl is allowed.
Sophie Dahl is allowed. Yes. Yes. Because she does fashion and Roald Dahl didn't.
It's so weird though, because it's like the oldest thing ever. It's like you go back to the 1920s and there's somebody being accused of nepotism because of their, you know, father was like in the talkies or whatever. Yeah. And it's like we're never not fascinated as a society. We're like, oh, well, I know their dad for a thing.
Yeah.
Even like the normal everyday like peasant on the street, you and me. It's like, oh, well, I remember her dad in that movie, so maybe I'll like this too. It's so apish. It's so stupid.
I think one thing that I have more tolerance of it with as well is with like when like supermodels have supermodel daughters, and it's like that makes
sense. Yeah, of course.
Because you've got like the most crazy genes that give you like
yeah,
the longest legs in the world.
Exactly. When they actually look like it. Yeah, you're like, well, fair enough. So, in short, starve your children of attention, and then when they get it, make sure that you don't let them become big-headed, because in interviews, the other cliche, the final one I'll end on, is that they say, oh, my friends and family always keep me down to earth if I ever thought I was getting big-headed, if they ever thought I was getting big-headed, and then you have to go, yes, I see. Basically, you just have to play mind games with your children, and they will become famous.
Well, that's all for this week. If you enjoyed listening to this episode, you can hear more by searching School for Dumb Women on your favourite podcast app and following us on the usual social media platforms at Dumb Women Pod. Thanks to Gavin Day for our artwork, Harry Harris for our jingles, and Zoho Radio Studios. Flar!
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 Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.